Today in Studio 360, Jeff Bridges. As an actor, he makes a point of playing a wide range of characters. Now he's putting himself out there as a singer-songwriter. So he can finally just be his totally authentic self, right? Maybe not.
I'm a character, too.
I guess you are.
We're all characters, you know. And I don't really know who the hell I am anyway.
The Dude Abides. Later in the show, a new statue of a freed slave has caused a big, surprising controversy in Indianapolis. We'll hear from the artist and from one of the work's opponents.
Public art, it can be challenging, but it cannot be in your face.
That and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, Jeff Bridges moonlights as a country western singer. I'm more than you've been feeling down and blue. There ain't nothing really wrong with you. You just need a little tending to. And my soul, what a little bit of love can do. And I'll also talk with a young South African woman whose new novel is a big deal in the science fiction world. But first, a work of public art is causing a big stir in Indianapolis, and it hasn't even gone up yet. African Americans have protested the work at civic meetings, in the media, and recently in a rally at the state capitol. The dispute involves a statue of a freed slave that was intended to be placed in downtown Indianapolis along the city's cultural trail. It's by the celebrated African American artist Fred Wilson, and it's called E Pluribus Unum. The figure of the freed slave is a quotation from the city's 1902 Civil War memorial. He's bowed down, shirtless, and holding up a flag. The artist, Wilson, wanted to take that guy off the memorial and give him a place of his own in the 21st century.
So that he is a person, he's a man, and he can represent something else than something positive.
Sounds reasonable to me, but not to a lot of people in Indianapolis, including Bill Crawford, who's a longtime state legislator. He says the proposed sculpture would perpetuate bad stereotypes.
The original sculpture had a representation of an African-American sitting down now, holding a flag, shoeless, bare-chested.
The original sculpture from 110 years ago.
Yes, from 110 years ago. And it was emblematic of the concept of noble suffering. We were not around. We had no power. The Ku Klux Klan was strong here.
Mm-hmm.
The proposal from Fred Wilson did not even allow for any evolution. The brother that was there, the only change they made was by adding the diaspora flag. So we're representing all the flags of all the nations where African slaves were there. But we've evolved from that. We can afford to buy our own shoes, our own pants. We're going to buy our own shirts now. We've come from slavery, actually, to the promised land with the election of an African-American male as the CEO of the most powerful nation in the world.
Do you appreciate, though, that, I mean, you may dislike, find objectionable that it isn't more modern or heroic in its depiction of African-Americans, but it certainly seems like it was well-intended, and the people who gave the money were well-intended.
The path to hell is paved with good intentions. Again, the question that I would ask, that I've got two grandchildren and then two great-grandchildren, what would inspire them looking at that? If they say, Granddaddy, what does that mean? Dr. King had a way of saying, we ain't what we ought to be, we ain't what we're going to be, but thank God we ain't what we was. And as long as we keep looking back to what we were, we are never going to be what we ought to be and what we're going to be. And the other thing that I find objectionable is the fact that in downtown Indianapolis, in the downtown Miles Square, where we benefit economically from all the conventions. There is one African-American business.
It sounds as though you're angry about your exclusion from the mainstream economy of Indianapolis and see this as a kind of small potato attempt at recompense.
Absolutely. I apologize if I went off on the radio.
That's okay.
Again, why was African Americans the only one to be acknowledged and singled out for recognition on the cultural trail? There are other ethnic groups here. That's something that is suspicious and sinister to me. I'm questioning the motivation. Why?
But you don't really think it was sinister. I mean,
I think it was sinister.
Really?
I absolutely do.
The people behind this decided, let's figure out a way to denigrate African Americans?
Denigrate by their lack of knowledge of what... We were an afterthought. It was like a plantation where the overseer of the plantation owners, decide what's going to happen, and everybody else has to go along.
So it's paternalistic, but not necessarily evil in intent.
That's a better word.
Okay. I want to play a little bit of tape of... We talked to Fred Wilson earlier. I just want to play a little bit of tape of him and see if you want to react to it.
Of course, it doesn't make me happy that people are upset with this particular sculpture, but I am really thrilled that people are in dialogue about imagery, the city, and how race is infused in that dialogue. You know, it's not about shutting down. It's about opening up, and it's a shame that for some it's just they've shut down.
I have nothing against Fred Wells. I have never met the man. In terms of dialogue, if Fred says that many voices are raised, I would agree with him, but the talk has all been one-sided.
So your view of public art, I guess, is that public art obliges the artist to come and be political and talk to the leaders and talk to the community as opposed to just do his or her art.
Yeah, public art, it can be challenging, but it cannot be in your face without asking our opinion, not necessarily our permission.
Right.
But at least ascertain our opinion.
Right.
Recognize us as human beings.
Representative Crawford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Crawford is about to serve his 40th year in the Indiana legislature. The group backing the statue is now looking for another site in Indianapolis, but they acknowledge that the whole thing may be 86th. The artist Fred Wilson is philosophical.
You know, the regrets I would have is if this sort of came up and I really felt I didn't do my best work. You know, I didn't make a work that I can stand behind. I put all my all into this piece, but in the end, the people of Indianapolis have to really come together, and I'll abide by whatever comes down the pike.
So what do you think about this controversy? How much input should artists have to get from the public when they make public art? Is there some work in your city that you find offensive? Tell us at studio360.org. Coming up, Jeff Bridges has acted in about 60 feature films, but some fans will probably always think of him as the character from The Big Lebowski, the dude. Does that bother him?
No, man.
No?
No. She kidnapped herself. You know, a young trophy wife in the parlance of our times, you know. She owes money all over town, including to known pornographers, and that's cool. Man in
me will do. The Dude is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. There's a little he would ask. Take a woman like you to get through to the man in me. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Last year, Jeff Bridges won an Academy Award for playing Bad Blake, a washed-up country singer in the film Crazy Heart.
Well, it rained last night.
You write me 5 new songs, I'll give you back in. I ship 2 million albums every time released.
I've written a new song in 3 years. Too many goddamn songs.
Now you write some of the best material out there, Bad. I want some.
Wrote. Not right.
Well, Jeff Bridges has written a lot of songs in real life. He's got a new album called Jeff Bridges that he's made with his old friend T-Bone Burnett, the legendary music producer. Jeff Bridges, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. Good to be here.
So, was there a direct connection between that role and that movie and deciding to do this record?
Yeah, I think there is a connection. I've been playing music since I've been a teenager. I put an album out about 10 years ago as well. So I've been, music has been a big part of my life for a long time. But you're right. I did figure after this movie, the turf was kind of primed for, making an album. If I ever wanted to make one, now was the time.
T-Bone Burnett has been on this program, partly I wanted him on because he seems kind of like this ubiquitous figure in all cool music of the last 2 generations. Did you learn stuff from him as you were making this record?
Oh, man, so much. I mean, one of the things that, one of the tips he gave me, he said, what I'm going to do for you, Jeff, is I'm going to make a playlist of all of the songs that Bad Blake would have listened to growing up in Fort Worth, because that's where T-Bone grew up and Stephen Bruton grew up. And the list included guys you might suspect, like Hank Williams and Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings and all those guys. But it also had cats like Ornette Coleman, who was also the great jazz saxophone player who was from Fort Worth. The Beatles and Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. And I remember asking him, how about Captain Beefheart? And Bone said, oh, yeah, Captain Beefheart's got to be on the list. So that, really opened the kind of list that or the kind of music that Bad Blake, might have been inspired by and enjoyed. That's one of Bone's specialties is sort of a genreless kind of music where he draws from so many different types of music that you can't really put his music in any one category.
I want to play a track, one of the ones you wrote called Falling Short. Where did this song come from?
Now, this is a very old song. This goes back, 30, maybe even 40 years. Bone and I went through about 60 or 70 songs, and if you're lucky on any kind of creative project, you bring stuff to it trying to make the thing. And then after a certain point, if you're lucky, it starts to tell you what it wants. And this was one of the songs that T-Bone responded to. And it still kind of, resonates with me as well. So it's an old song. It's about falling short, being so concerned with hitting this the bullseye, the target that you're aiming for, that sometimes you're missing what is really there for you to receive, that you're not able to appreciate because you're so concentrated on this little target.
Am I falling short, or do I fly? Well, I miss the mark. Do I hit the sky? In my wondering, do I answer why I'm alive? To make a space, bushwhackle path, leave a sign, dodge the rest. Myself and leave the math to God.
That's Falling Short, written and performed by Jeff Bridges with, who's accompanying you there?
I believe that's Sam Phillips.
Uh-huh. Who you have on this record along with Roseanne Cash?
Oh, man, there's Roseanne Cash and, you know, it's like making movies.
Uh-huh.
Casting is about, it's about 99% of the whole deal, you know, bringing the artists together and then kind of letting them rip. And you know, I look to T-Bone as a director. And what I'm looking for in a director is, you know, someone who can create the environment for everyone to do their best work. And usually that comes from a very kind of relaxed place.
When you're acting, you're inside a character who may bear some slight resemblance to who you are, but it's a character. Here, it's you, right? I mean, are the experiences of recording these songs with emotional authenticity, is that a very different thing than playing a character in a film?
Oh, I'm a character, too.
I guess you are.
We're all characters, you know. And, you know, I don't really know who the hell I am anyway. I remember doing an interview once, and some guy, he was over at my house, and some guy asked me, so are you one of those kind of actors that, you know, all the other actors have to call you by your character's name, and, you know, do you bring your work home? Are you constantly in character? And I said, no, I'm not really one of those guys. And my wife happened to be in the room, and she, you know, let out a big snort and guffawed. And I said, what is that all about? And she said, well, you don't think you bring it home, but you do.
And as you say, as a public persona, and God knows making a record is a public enactment of a version, a guy called Jeff Bridges, the character Jeff Bridges, who's a singer.
That's right.
The role you're probably most famous for is the dude in the 1998 movie The Big Lebowski. Do you feel relieved now with this new efflorescence of success you've had the last couple of years to be getting away from being the dude?
No, man.
No?
No.
Good. Well, let's listen to a clip of that film for any of our listeners who are not yet fully Lebowski crazed.
Hey, man.
How do you do, dude?
I wondered if I'd see you again.
I wouldn't miss the semis. How things been going?
You know, strikes and gutters, ups and downs.
Sure, I've got you.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. Well, take care, man. Gotta get back.
Sure. Take it easy, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you will.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
That phrase, the dude abides, is I've seen on hats, I've seen on T-shirts. It is part of the, you know, it's one of those American cultural icons now. As you, there are now Lebowski festivals. Why do you think that film and that character, your character, became such a cult object, bigger than any other one I can even imagine of the last dozen years?
Man, it's just such a good movie. Those guys, those brothers, the Coen brothers, they just know how to do it, man. It's just like falling off a log for them. But I'm a when I watch the TV, I'm a clicker guy. You know, I'll just spin the channels. And
you're
I'll,
a guy, in other words.
And I'll normally, you know, when a movie come, I'll watch a little bit. You know, movie of mine, I'll watch a scene or two. And with Lebowski, it'll be, you know, I'm just going to watch till Turturro licks the ball, and then I'm going to spin.
That is a bowling ball.
Yes. Thank you for that. We must clarify that for the unknowledgeable Lebowski people. But I get hooked, you know. I mean, it's just like a mind candy, that thing. Just one great scene after another, and wonderful characters.
I'm not sure there's any American actor these days who is, among all the other things you've done, and are so beloved by the people who come to see the movies. And I was trying to figure out why that is. And I guess, he seems authentic and comfortable in his skin and just like a regular middle American guy. Yet you're the Southern California son of a movie star. You don't have the bio of a regular middle American guy at all. So how does that all happen? Why do you sound like you grew up in West Texas?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, you know, for one thing, a big movie in my filmography is, you know, The Last Picture Show.
Right.
And that was shot in Wichita, you know, outside of Wichita Falls, Archer City. And I've got a real connection with Texas as far as playing several stories that take place here. But the other thing you're talking about, I don't know. You know, my folks really they always taught us kids about the family of man, you know, how we're all in this together. We're all one big family. And so maybe that's, you know, I go out and do my work and I'm kind of representing the family.
So you were well brought up is what the explanation is.
I think so. I mean, I had some cool parents, man. I mean, both of them were really, you know, really unique. Not perfect, you know, not perfect by any means, but gosh, they gave us a lot of love.
In 2008, to demonstrate your range, that you're not always playing cowboyish, grizzled cowboyish guys, you were in one of the stars of the film How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, in which you played a character who runs a big glossy magazine like Vanity Fair and who's based on my old friend Graydon Carter, the real-life editor of Vanity Fair, who created Spy Magazine back in the 80s with me. I want to play a scene where your character in How to Lose Friends and Alienate People argues with a reporter.
A free press is the last defense against the tyranny of stupidity.
Save me your tin pot philosophy.
It's not mine, it's yours. First issue of Snipe.
Would you grow the fuck up? You are not Robin Hood. You never were. You bitch about famous people for the same reason I used to bitch about them. Because they got invited to the party and you didn't. Well, Sydney, you're at the party now.
That's Jeff Bridges in How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. Just hearing your voice in that film versus your voice here now versus your much more Texan voice in Crazy Heart that we heard earlier, just on that level, there are different versions of Jeff Bridges that are available.
Yeah, that's one of the things I set out to really try to do. My father, Lloyd Bridges, he had a lot of success in this early 60s with a TV series called Sea Hunt.
I remember it well.
And he was so good in that part of Mike Nelson that people thought he was a skin diver.
Yes.
And so the result of that was that he got a lot of skin diving scripts.
I didn't know there were a lot of skin diving scripts.
Yes, exactly. And while he was, you know, it was, you know, terrific in some ways, you know. It was frustrating for him because he's not too many people know that he replaced Richard Kiley in Man of La Mancha on Broadway. You know, he's a Shakespearean actor. He's a wonderful comedian. So he had a lot of frustration developing that strong persona. So I really kind of set out to not do that, and I do my best to shift my characters around from movie to movie. And also, I think, you know, being a movie lover myself, I know when I go see a movie where a guy, where one of the main actor has a strong persona, it's very hard for me to place him in this new character, you know, when I've seen him as this other guy. So, you know, I remember after Lebowski, it was wonderful to play the President of the United States in The Contender. You know, that's that kind of thing. I kind of go for that.
Jeff Bridges, I want to thank you very much, and congratulations on this album. It's terrific.
Thank you, Kirk. Good talking to you, man.
Jeff Bridges' new album is out right now, and it's called Jeff Bridges.
Well, I came out swinging through the center field wall, and I caught a fastball, and I touched them all. But I burned out my engines and needed a break. Where all that's required is the time it would take. Now I'm done doing nothing and weary of rest. And I've got to get back to the quest. Thank you.
From time to time, we ask people about works of art that change their lives. Neil Finn is the lead singer of the band Crowded House, who had several hits back in the late 20th century.
There is freedom within, there is freedom without. Try to catch the deluge in a paper cup.
He came of age in New Zealand in the late 1960s and 70s, and it was the big British pop of that era that turned him onto music.
It was late in the Beatles' career and the early 70s where people like David Bowie were hugely influential. Those songs, I was trying to emulate them. Elton John's early stuff, I was playing piano and playing guitars and trying to emulate those guys.
But then, years later, when Finn was on a solo tour of the United States, for the first time, he heard the music of a group called ESG. ESG had never made it out of obscurity in the early 1980s.
I was in the back lounge of the tour bus. It's a lively place to be at the end of a night after a show. I was in a very receptive state. I just loved it. It sounds so good. It's so empty, so minimal. So against the grain in terms of my background. It's got a really badass groove. It's built on bass and drums and some freaky sounds. They sound like they mean it, you know? I played it to my wife, and she really dances very well. She's a great dancer. She just immediately loved it as well, and so we found ourselves putting that one on at gatherings and late at night and having a good old dance around the living room. There's something about those rhythms that gets me going. It was years later where we were just sitting there and our boys had left home. We just said, well, we should go and have a jam and we should try and do something like ESG would do. And we went in there and I jumped on the drums and she on bass, and she may have done something very similar to the bass line in that song, It's All Right. For about half an hour with me kind of applying myself to just staying on the groove.
It's all right, baby.
It's all right, honey. It's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right.
I don't think I was prepared for the experience of having a kind of music that I've not ever played suddenly seem accessible to me. Was the exciting thing about it. There is no more fun to be had making music than playing drums. I only discovered that since this has happened.
These are conditions in my head. These are conditions in my head. High upon the day, heavy as a cloud about to rain.
And I do credit the ESG record for allowing me to believe that you could base something on incredibly simple groove with a kind of an energy and an abandon, and it would be great music. Yeah, they brought out something latent, something exciting.
You are the one who disappears, lost in the slumber.
ESG, I think, were quoted at some point as saying they were trying to sound like James Brown but weren't good enough. My wife and I have just formed a band due to the inspiration of ESG, built on bass and drums, and we're trying to sound like them but we're not good enough.
Do you still remember what it
there some song that changed your way of looking at the world when you first heard it? Or a book or a movie? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org. Coming up, with electric cars becoming real things, Hollywood contemplates the end of the gasoline-fueled car explosion.
I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's kind of laughable that every car that gets in an accident in Hollywood, you know, blows up.
Will action movies ever be the same? That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Studio 360, I'm Kurt Anderson. The 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks is approaching, so we here at Studio 360 are putting together a list of what we think are the best works of fiction and music and movies and other works of art that came out of those events. A listener, Josh Plock from Georgia, is a big comic book fan. He says he felt inspired when his heroes stepped up in the face of nihilistic terror.
Captain America was the one I noticed it most in because, you know, the Star-Spangled Avenger who first started off fighting Hitler, he was now fighting terrorists. Superheroes weren't just things that fought each other. They stood for something. They stood for America, what was best in Americans, especially after these attacks. I've grown up with these characters, so to see them going through it really helped me deal with what was going on.
We also heard from a lot of people who were comforted by music written after 9/11.
This is Stacy Kerr calling in from Santa Rosa, California. The song I always think of is called September 11 at the Shambhala Center. It was written by Terry Roach. And it deals with fear and saying not to lose your nerve. When you're scared, look up. There's somebody watching.
When you're scared, look up.
September 11th isn't the only scary thing that's ever happened to us or that will ever happen to us. And keeping some faith in the light of scary things isn't easy. That one still, it pulls tears from my eyes. It's just so healing and so perceptive and so compassionate, and mostly it's just so brave.
That was Stacy Kerr and Josh Plock. Is there a piece of music or a novel or some other work of art that hits home for you in this way? What would you add to Studio 360's 9/11 cultural shortlist? Tell us at studio360.org. Until the movie District 9 came out a couple of years ago, the term South African science fiction was pretty much a null set for most of us. But District 9 was one of the best sci-fi films of the decade, a very realistic story about what would happen if a spaceship full of insecty alien creatures finally did show up here on Earth. So I was intrigued when I discovered that the winner of this year's Arthur C. Clarke Award, pretty much the Pulitzer of science fiction, is a writer from South Africa. The book is called Zoo City. It's a noir crime novel set in a world very much like ours, but in one big way, not. The author is Lauren Bucus, and she's here with me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So most people still think, I think, that science fiction means the future. If I'm not mistaken, Zoo City takes place more or less nowish.
It does. I think science fiction is a very broad church, and it can mean a lot of things. And a lot of people imagine that it means space aliens and alien invasion. And it's just a kind of a way of exploring the world and putting a twist on the world as we know it.
And are you comfortable with science fiction? I know there's an ongoing debate in these worlds of writers between imaginative fiction and speculative fiction and fantasy and science fiction fantasy. Do you care?
I find the whole genre wars very painful. I find it as painful as kind of the artificial war between creationists and atheists. You know, I think most people read what
they want
to read.
That's a real wall.
But you know what? It's mainly characterized by loud voices on either side, and most of us fall in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same with genre. Most of us read what we want to read, and we don't worry too much about the classifications.
Right. And when people say to you, oh, that's nice, you write science fiction. I don't read science fiction. What is your comeback?
It's a tough one. I do get that. And I think my comeback is that it's a way of examining issues that we're very tired of. We get issue fatigue. You know, we don't want to hear about the war in Afghanistan and refugees in the DRC, and it's too much to deal with.
Right.
And science fiction and story is a way of kind of putting a twist on that you can actually, that makes it accessible, that makes it personal, that makes it a story you can relate to. So, yeah, I try and sell people on kind of more the noir elements.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that it's this crazy detective story.
Right, that it is. So Zoo City, explain who the people, like the narrator, are who are called zoos.
Well, something has happened in this world. No one's quite sure. It's been kind of an ontological shift. And criminals or people who've done very, very bad things are magically bonded to an animal, which kind of appears out of nowhere. And you can tell a criminal because they're walking down the street with a rhino or an anteater or a sparrow, whatever it is. And it immediately stigmatizes them. It's like a furry scarlet letter. And Zinzia December is a woman with a bad drug habit, which she's trying to get over. She's got a prison record for something terrible, which she did. And she has a sloth on her back, which gives her the magical ability to find lost things. And she can kind of trace your lost things from your head and follow them all the way home. And she is asked to find a missing pop star. And it all goes very, very wrong from there.
And all these zoos tend to live together in a kind of segregated, crappy part of Johannesburg where
Absolutely.
It takes place.
In many ways, Zoo City is an apartheid allegory. You know, it's about stigmatization. It's about how we ghettoize people, the same way genre fiction is ghettoized. And it's about poverty. It's about economics. It's about refugees. It's about xenophobia. It's about living with the burden of the past and trying to come to terms with that.
I mean, did this begin as, oh, I want to write an allegory about the apartheid of my country, South Africa, but I don't want to have it be about race?
No, I think that was much more my first book,
Moxieland.
Yeah, which is very much a corporate apartheid state. Zoo City it started with an image. I had a very strong image, which developed almost like a Polaroid in the back of my head, of a young woman walking into a tenement slum, going to the cupboard and pulling a sloth out and kind of putting it on like a backpack. And I knew that it was at once a terrible burden, but also the possibility of redemption. And I kind of started to figure it out from there.
And were you, as you started to figure this out as a story, aware of, did you do research into all of the various folkloric versions of the animal familiar and all that stuff
Definitely.
For thousands of years?
Yeah, you know, like a lot of people are like, oh, well, that's very Philip Pullman. But the fact is that we've had animalistic and totem animals and animal familiars for a very long time. From the ancient Hebrew scapegoat, which was literally a goat that you put your sins into and then sacrificed, through to the idea of Mashavi, which is a South African idea, which is that ancestor worship is a big thing in South Africa. And sometimes the spirits of the ancestors get lost. And sometimes those lost spirits attach themselves to an animal, which could then attach itself to a person.
You when you were describing the premise earlier, you said, and magically attached to these animals. It's never clear if it's magic or if there's simply some undiscovered, perfectly rational scientific explanation for these connections.
I think, you know, some people get frustrated that the novel doesn't have clear set answers to everything. But you know what? The world we live in doesn't. We all have different theories. Right. We all have major different religions. None of us knows what happens after we die. We have theories.
Right.
And that's something I wanted to reflect in the book, a whole bunch of different theories. And I wanted the reader to bring their own theories as well.
Uh-huh. The South African movie, which I mentioned, District 9, had alien creatures. You have these maybe magical human beings. But in this book, like in that movie, race hardly figures explicitly. Is science fiction in part a way to actually imagine and talk and think about a post-racial society, or is the race there as an allegorical thing all the way?
Look, I think District 9 was problematic in many ways, with the Nigerian depiction in particular. But it was specifically about refugees and xenophobia.
How is that problematic?
The fact that he, unfortunately, the fact that the alien shagging, drug dealing, body part hacking off people were specifically name-checked as Nigerian. And I think he could have totally got around that by just giving them a gang name. And I think that reinforced xenophobia, which was a big problem in South Africa.
Oh, the anti-Nigerian xenophobia in South Africa.
And which is a huge problem. And it was interesting also because it was being filmed at the time of the xenophobic attacks in 2008 when a lot of black South Africans rose up and attacked black foreigners, which was very traumatic and devastating. And of course that all ties into economic issues and poverty and inequality and lack of opportunity and all kinds of things, you know, deep social rot.
Which in Zoo City you deal with as the milieu but not so much as the story.
No, you know what, it was... And I'm always interested when people say that they don't see race issues in the book. I think it's not explicit. I think it's so much part of the experience that I didn't think to comment on it specifically.
Uh-huh.
But I do think that's also an experience of post-democratic South Africa. But of course, we're still dealing with the legacy of apartheid, and that's f***ed up a lot of people.
As a white South African, how did you approach writing in the voice of a black character in the first person?
It's what a fiction writer does, but it was certainly something I was worried about. You know, writing outside, I mean, writers do it all the time. We write outside our gender, we write outside our experience. But race is obviously very provocative in South Africa. So one of the things that I did was I approached a novelist friend of mine, Zukiswa Wana, who was up for the Commonwealth Prize recently, and I asked her to do a cultural edit to make sure that I wasn't doing...
That Zinzi December was... real enough.
Exactly. And it was interesting because she sent me about 5 pages of notes and there was amazing stuff like she said, no, she would never smoke a Stuyvesant cigarette. The cigarettes you buy on the street in Johannesburg are Remington Gold. And I was like, oh, that's great. That's amazing. I'm going to change that. And I got to the end of her notes and I was like, and I phoned her up and I was like, dude, you haven't answered my main question. And she was like, well, what's your main question? I'm like, well, is Zinzi black enough? And she laughed at me. And she said, what is black enough? There are so many different ways of being black. Is she Zinzi enough? Yes. And that's really what you need to worry about.
Was there a single moment when you were young or younger when you realized I'm going to be a fiction writer? And was it I'm going to be a science fiction writer?
I was 5 years old. I was reading a lot of Enid Blyton. And then somebody told me that Enid Blyton had made £1 million from her writing.
Who is she?
She's a very famous British children's writer. She wrote The Famous Five and The Secret Seven and all kinds of high adventure stuff. And it never occurred to me that it could be a viable career. It wasn't so much the fact that she was rich off it, but the fact that you actually could get paid money to make stuff up.
There was no J.K. Rowling yet.
Yeah, no, there was no J.K. Rowling. But that would have been a really good inspiration as well. So yeah, and I read a lot of science fiction. My next book is not necessarily going to be science fiction. I'd like to position myself as a kind of a Margaret, along the same lines as Margaret Atwood or David Mitchell, who write what they want to write.
Who write literary fiction sometimes in a science fictional mode.
Absolutely.
And do you intend to spend the rest of your life in South Africa?
I think so. It is an incredibly rich and interesting place. It's incredibly inspiring. And it is home. And home is deep-rooted. And it's also a country that I believe in. I believe that we can pull through all our problems. We can get through the legacy of apartheid, and try and build a better South Africa. And I think what always surprises me is South Africa's ability to reconcile. And that's something I was also trying to explore with Zoo City. When our apartheid Nationalist Party president died, the ANC actually had a state funeral for him. And I was like, what are you doing? He was this racist, awful human being who nearly tore the entire country apart. But they were able to reach out and offer that gesture of reconciliation. And that was amazing to me, that we have that capacity for forgiveness and that capacity to reach out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Lauren Buick's new novel is called Zoo City. It recently won the biggest prize in science fiction, the Arthur C. Clarke Award. And you can hear her reading from the novel at studio360.org. Sometimes science fiction turns into reality, like, for instance, the electric car. Most of the major automakers now have electric models in the works for 2012, and some, like the Nissan Leaf, are already quietly purring around town. Wonderful, right? Well, maybe not if you make your living in Hollywood. Say you're shooting an action movie. What would you do without that big car crash that always ends with the gas tanks exploding spectacularly? Does an electric car explode? We sent Robert Moore to find out if green technology means the end of one of America's signature contributions to cinema.
Okay, picture this. It's the year 2030. Your granddaughter is sitting there beside you on the couch, and you're flipping through the channels on your holographic television, when suddenly you stumble across the 1993 comedy Groundhog Day on Turner Classic Movies. Bill Murray's character is behind the wheel of a stolen pickup truck with the groundhog sitting on his lap, and he's speeding towards the edge of a cliff.
Bill!
He might be okay. No, probably not now.
You're cracking up, but your granddaughter just turns to you, confused. Why'd the car explode, she asks. Well, because, you say. The gas tank. What's a gas tank, she replies.
I think the golden era for the exploding car was the 90s.
That's Matt Zoller-Seitz, a film critic for Salon.
That was the exploding car what the 60s was for rock and roll. I mean, it was like the British invasion of exploding cars, the 90s.
The 90s, remember, was the heyday of gas guzzlers. But now, electric cars are on the rise. And while that's good for the planet, Seitz worries about its effects on Hollywood. He says he hates to see a time-honored trope fade away.
I think movies haven't really recovered from the loss of the answering machine. It was such a handy way to find out where exactly someone was in their life. You know, they come home and you hear, you know, Bill, this is your mother, call me, beep. I hate you, I don't ever want to talk to you again, beep. I'm sorry, you didn't get that job, beep, you know.
For decades, car explosions have served a similar function. In the grammar of film, there are exclamation points. And not just in summer popcorn movies, they're also a big part of Oscar-winning dramas, like Paul Haggis's Crash.
Okay. There's something very volatile, something very cinematic about gasoline.
But there's nobody else here yet, and that's gasoline there.
I think that's what we're really talking about here. I don't think it's the cars. I think it's the oil. I think it's the petroleum products that we're going to miss. And in fact, I think that the makers of electric batteries would probably be wise to have some kind of exploding feature in them just to enable this kind of mayhem to continue. Otherwise, we're all going to be really sad when we go to the movies, you know?
But wait a minute. How do we know electric cars don't explode? Like, what if you, say, drove one off a cliff?
If it were pretty charged and you drove it off a cliff, having a fire start is probably fairly likely.
Amy Prieto teaches chemistry at Colorado State. She's an expert on lithium batteries.
The lithium in the anode can actually catch on fire. And then the other electrode, the cathode material, once that starts decomposing, it generates oxygen, which keeps the fire going.
And can you walk us through what that would look like?
Well, the first thing I should tell you is you should not stick around long enough to watch it, because one of the products of exposure to moisture is a really toxic acid. But the fires that you would see would probably be white hot, and I guess because there's lithium in it, you could see some bluish tinge.
I called up Steven Summers to share the good news.
Hello.
He's directed a string of hit action movies, including 2009's G.I. Joe. That movie destroyed a record-breaking 109 automobiles, which I guess you could say makes Summers the world's foremost authority on vehicular carnage.
I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's kind of laughable that every car that gets in an accident in Hollywood, you know, blows up. And that's why if you look at the 109 cars we destroyed and that whole sequence, the only time there's an explosion is because there were rockets involved, not because there was gas in a gas tank.
I asked Summers if he had any advice for filmmakers who will one day be working with electric cars.
Sure, fire a rocket at it. because I didn't know until you just told me what happens when a lithium battery is punctured, and if you said it punctures and it sprays and it could melt human beings, I'd go with that.
But won't he kind of miss all those big, spectacular fireballs?
Whether we make movies about the Civil War or outer space, there's always explosions. I mean, you know, when there's explosions in space, there wouldn't be really balls of flame. So every explosion in Star Wars is complete phony baloney, but we don't care. It's fun. It's all part of the fun. We'll figure out a way to have great explosions, no matter what cars are made of.
For the sake of my grandkids, I hope he's right. For Studio 360, I'm Robert Moore.
Electric car.
on roads so dark, to change the end, rewrite the start. Electric car, so good so far. Electric car on verdant green.
So if spectacular exploding car crashes are a thing of the past, we want to remember them correctly. In your opinion, what's the best one? We'll be collecting your suggestions at studio360.org. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Liz Fiella.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
This should be a book that's read every 5 years because it's like food, man. It ain't McDonald's, man. The autobiography of Malcolm X is sit down, say grace, and eat your food very slowly as we sit around this table and do it.
Public Enemy's Chuck D on the autobiography of Malcolm X. That's next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.